history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some men and women around you who have incredible stories to tell, ordinary Americans who have done extraordinary things, and it's our privilege to meet them each week. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation, like the story we're going to hear today in Fort Collins, Colorado, from Mike Martinez, just turned 92 years old. He's a Colorado native, but Fort Collins is a big city compared to where you grew up. I asked you where your hometown was. You said there wasn't even a town. You're just out in the middle of nowhere?
That is correct. The Dunner Disappointment is what the area was called.
Disappointment. Now, that's encouraging.
Yes, and the Dunner. I mean, there ain't nothing there, and there hasn't been nothing there but I don't know. There may be something there because I haven't been there for a while. I left there in the 40s and ain't been back because there was nothing, really nothing, you know, and all my friends had moved out. So that's about it for that part of the country as far as I know.
You were the second of seven children in your family. So what was that childhood like out there in the middle of nowhere? What kinds of stuff did you do?
Oh, we played out on the farm. You know, actually, we didn't really play. We had to farm. We had to work. As we grew up, we done a lot of work in the farm, and naturally that helped our parents. We raised some cows, and we had to take care of them crazy cows, and therefore, you know, you got your horses and worked with them, and you made sure the horses and the cows ate and got up every morning, especially in the wintertime, and fed your cows. And it's kind of nice getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning to feed a crazy cow. But we had, I guess it was great to do that. No, we had a lot of fun.
Did you have to milk them too?
No, that's too many to milk. We was only playing with 1,000 cows, and then I don't think you could milk that many. But we did have a milk cow, yes. And sometimes, yes, we took turns milking that to have milk at the house. And, you know, you had your own cream there, and everything was done at home. You bought very little stuff at the time because it took you a couple of days to go to the store because there was no car in the neighborhood. And I remember back in the 30s, my dad bought a car. We was going to have it made, so he parked it. He cranked on that crazy thing one winter, all winter. Never got it started till summer come. So he jumps in the car and takes off uptown. Guess what? He didn't come back in a car. He come back on a horse. So that's the last car we had till in the late 30s or early 40s is when we finally got another vehicle. It was something else. And I'll never forget. He bought a brand new pickup and he paid $700 for it. And today, you can't believe that. That you bought a vehicle for that kind of money.
But back then, that was a ton of money.
Oh, you bet. See, gold was, $30 an ounce. And look at the price of gold today. More like $2,000. I think it's $1,500, actually, for an ounce of gold. Mm-hmm. So that makes a big difference. And there's not as much gold today as there was then. It was great living that kind of life, I guess, because you kept busy. And today's life is a lot different in a way, but in a way it's still the same. You still got to go out there and work for what you got.
Well, and your job after the war would be in mining. But yes. Growing up, as a kid out there in western Colorado, do you remember having some hopes, some dreams, some ideas of what you were going to do someday?
Yes, I did. I decided I'd go to college, and finally I did. And I went to college to become an electronic engineer and worked on a broadcast station and a couple of them, and away we went. But the mining, I took mining when I first got out of service because there's no work and you couldn't get any money. So we were standing in the corner one day, and an old friend of mine come up and wanted to know what we was doing. We told him, he said, "Well, why don't you guys go to work in the mines? They paid big money." And we did. Went over there, we got a job, and we were happy with that for a while. So we were happy campers working around Telluride there in the mines. It was pretty good. There was a lot of work. You could quit one shift and go to another one the same day. That's just how scary. Because it's pretty dangerous work in the mines. A lot of people got killed. But, you know, it's just one of them things you got to put up with. And life is that way, just like driving a car here in town. A lot of people get killed driving a car, and mining was no different, as I consider it. But it was a dangerous job, but the money was good. There was no place else that made that kind of money, so we were happy campers digging for gold over there and had a great time.
Well, and you talk about dangerous jobs. There's no more dangerous time in your life than being in Bastogne during the Battle of the Bulge, and we're going to hear about that. But I want to ask you about something else first. Seems like everybody who was alive on December 7th, 1941, has some kind of memory about how that word came to them. Do you remember how you found out about Pearl Harbor?
We was sitting at the house. Dad heard it first. Her mother heard it, don't remember which one, and let us know that the Pearl Harbor had been hit. Because, see, if it wasn't out early in the morning, you didn't hear it, because we were never at home. Mother was the only one at home, and we were all out working the fields and taking care of what had to be done. So and she was the first one that heard it, and she let us know when we come to lunch. And then I thought it was pretty rough, but I never thought of going to the surface at the time. Why, I do not know, but later on I did, and I went, didn't volunteer. I could have got what they call a deferment, but I did not want a deferment. I volunteered, and I thought I was never going to live that down. I thought Mother was going to kill me, but she didn't. I managed to survive when I come home and told her what I'd done. And that was something else. You know, tell your mother, well, I just joined the service and took my basic training in California. And guess who I took my basic training? As a neighbor there was old Red Skelton. Many people remember him, many don't, because he's gone now. He's been gone for a while. But we had a lot of fun, and he was a good guy to get along with.
So a lot of things I want to ask you about here. So first of all, you said you could have had a deferment. And so people understand, was that because of the farming operation, because you guys were growing things that were needed?
Yes, that is because of kind of the farming and, you know, and things needed to be taken care of, and we were raising what the public wanted out there. So I could have got a deferment without any problem at all. Mm-hmm. But Dad didn't dig it up, and my mother didn't push on it too hard, I guess, and they let me go and do what I wanted. So I thought that was great.
So where did that come from? Where did that idea to go sign up and knowing your mom's going to be mad at you? What got into you?
Because a lot of your friends around were gone. A lot, you know, all the boys in the country left about that time. The country was getting very thin on boys. There was very few of them left. There was all, you become of age, you was gone. Even the marriage ones were gone. And Dad was a World War I vet, so he didn't worry too much about it because he was disabled, and he got to stay home. He didn't have to worry about going to war on World War II. I understand a few people did, but my dad did not. He stayed home and helped us take care of things, and he did die at an early age. He was in his 40s when he passed away. He had a heart problem one morning and didn't wake up when he went to bed. One of them things that Mother Nature does for us, which is great. We don't suffer too much that way, I don't think. So it was a good way to go.
Did he ever tell you anything about what he did in World War I?
No, he didn't talk too much about that. It's like we are today. We don't tell our kids much. Why, I do not understand. I can talk to a stranger and tell him what went on, yes, but talk to your kids, that's a whole different ballgame. Why we do not talk to the kids, I do not know. Oh, some of them will dig it out of you, yes, but a lot of them don't.
Well, when you set the example by telling your story, it helps others to tell theirs, so I'm glad we're having this conversation today. So you go sign up, they send you out to California. Where in California was your basic training?
Camp Roberts. Can't remember the name of the town.
Paso Robles and Red Skelton, but he wasn't Red Skelton yet, right?
Yes, he was.
He was. He was famous already.
He was already famous, and he was something else. Every time he drew extra duty, he'd hire somebody to do it for him, and away he'd go, you know, because he had the money. The rest of us was broke, per se, because we got big money at the time. You know, we got 50 cents a day. So can you imagine drawing 50 cents a day today?
Yeah, good luck with that. So was he entertaining the rest of you guys? Was he cracking jokes and doing funny stuff or what?
A lot of times he did, yes, but he was just a regular guy to get along with. He was not a bad guy. And after we separated there, he used to write to all his friends there, and I used to get some letters from him, but we never replied. Why, I do not know, because we could have his signature down there in a lot of letters, you know, that he wrote. And it would have been great, but we didn't save the letters or anything. Mainly, I guess, especially when we hit Europe, because we didn't have a place to store anything. We just threw everything in the wayside. That was one thing, and I wish I'd have at least one letter from him, but I don't.
But you still have the memories, and I did look up some info on Red Skelton's time in the Army. He'd been a radio and film star before the war, And after that training that he had with Mike, Skelton spent so much time entertaining the troops that he actually wore himself out. He did sometimes as many as 10 1.5-hour shows a day for servicemen on troop ships going back and forth to Europe. He ended up with a nervous breakdown and developed a severe stuttering issue. Red Skelton actually ended up at an Army hospital in Virginia trying to recover. And while he was there, he met a wounded soldier whose plight was so jarring that Skelton just had to find a way to make him laugh and take that soldier's mind off the pain and suffering. That effort to make another soldier's life better ended up curing Red Skelton of his stutter and helped him get back to work as an entertainer. So for you, you do your basic training out there, and there are a lot of different things that you can do in the Army. Was there something that you were hoping they would let you do?
Not really, because they don't. Only thing you knew you was going to do is kill that dude across the street, you know. It was very rough. So I drawed a 50 caliber machine gun, and I guess I enjoyed it, but no, not really, because the Germans liked it too well and took two or three of them away from us. And that's the way it was, you know.
What about, it strikes me as I'm just listening to what you've shared already, growing up in rural western Colorado, where when you guys finally got a car, it didn't even work that well, and your dad comes home riding a horse. So to be in the Army and to have all these Jeeps and trucks and tanks and all these things around, was that like a kid in a candy store or what?
Oh, you bet. It was something else. And everybody wanted to drive, but we didn't all get a chance to drive. And I was one of the guys that really didn't get a chance to drive. But they did treat us pretty well about that. Every place we went, you know, we didn't have to walk. And the infantry did. We done a lot of riding. And sometimes we regretted it because, you know, especially when we got to hit France there and up through the Bulls there, the Germans loved to see them convoys coming up because they'd really clean them out.
Well, and before you ever got there, you had a long journey. And I imagine for, again, a guy who grew up where you did, the way you did, getting on a ship and heading overseas had to be something new.
Oh, it was. And that ship we went in was a Queen Mary, which, you know, is a little one. That thing is a pretty good-sized boat. And how many people they put in there was unbelievable, but the only room we had was standing room. That's just how crowded it was. And we went on a big convoy, and we took extra time because we went one way and then back the other way. And in the mornings, every once in a while, you'd see one of the ships over there smoking. The Germans got to it and hit it. And I do know that there was a few times we went up there to the rail ready to jump off the boat and take off out in the middle of the ocean. Now, that would have been something, you know. I'm glad I didn't get to do that. It was quite an experience to get out there and get ready to bail the boat.
Because there were submarines in the area and you thought you were going to be hit?
That is correct. There was a lot of submarines in the area. That's how come you'd get up in the morning and see some smoking ships out there and in the edge of our convoy. Because it's a pretty good-sized convoy. We went one direction one day and another direction the other day, because they wanted to confuse the Germans and not let them know where we were going. But more or less, they had to know because, Europe and Japan are two big different directions.
Yeah, and you're talking about that zigzag pattern to foil the subs, and thankfully you guys did make it. And I know this is 72 years ago, so it's kind of hard to remember. But do you recall what your expectations were? I mean, did you really think that you'd be coming back to Colorado after you were done over there?
Really? I did not know. Really, I thought I might be laying there with the rest of some of the gang that we went with, because I mean to tell you, you got up some mornings and all you could see was bodies laying all over the yards. It was something else, especially when we hit there after D-Day. The bodies that was out there in the mornings when you see men, it was pathetic. There was hundreds of dead people out there, Americans and Germans.
And that's really the first thing you saw when you landed in Normandy? I mean, this is a little while after D-Day, but you still saw the remnants of that?
Oh, yes, because, see, the Germans were trying to hold it very strongly, and we were trying to take it very strongly. So we lost a lot of troops there. The Germans lost their share, and we lost our share. So it was more or less an equal balance, but the Americans won, and I'm glad they did, or I would have never come back. I really don't know how to explain it till you got up. You went out there and all you seen was bodies laying over there for I don't know how many yards. And naturally, we had to go over there and search. We would say for other things, but we had to go over there and search for guns. We didn't want to leave any guns in there because we didn't know what civilians were still strongly for the German side, and they would get the guns and shoot us with them. So we went over there and policed the area for guns. And that's why instead of any other souvenir, we were out there especially looking for guns. We had to collect all the, because there were a lot of handguns and stuff like that. We had, I guess, more or less protect ourselves. So that's why we had that.
So this is really your first duty in Europe, is to go through the lines and lines of dead bodies and see if there are any guns left. That's the first thing you had to do?
No, we had to defend the area first. And then, you know, but when we got up in the mornings, we would see what was out there. And any time it was possible, you did go search the dead bodies for guns, because them guns were going to be, if they were left there, they were going to be used on you. So you had to, you know, kind of eliminate the guns, because the Germans supposedly was not selling any more guns. So the ones that you got would be off of the dead bodies out there.
So you're a 19-year-old kid, and you're seeing all this, death all around you. How did you handle that?
That's a tough one to explain. I just don't know how. Actually, I was not 19 years old yet, because I had served all my duties and everything, and I was home when, by the time I was 21. I had my birthday at the age of 21 back in the good old USA. Mama cooked my birthday lunch, and I was a happy camper. So I was pretty young. I kind of snuck out and volunteered before my age, and that's the reason my mother was ready to hang me when she found out about that. But I'm glad I got away from her, and she never did.
You mentioned that birthday lunch. What's a birthday lunch from Mama Martinez look like? What did she cook for you?
She cooked a big old cake and stuff like that, you know. And naturally, in my bringing up, we had steak about every day. Steak and beans was the main course. Well, we had little potatoes with it, you know. And it was great. It was something you really enjoyed. But that cake made the day.
But you had to get through a lot to be home for that 21st birthday, and that's what I want to hear about. And I want to understand what your duties were. So you're in a field artillery battalion. What kind of gun were you operating?
A 50-caliber machine gun.
Okay, we're going to get more into that when we come back. 92-year-old Mike Martinez of Fort Collins, Colorado, is our guest. You're going to find photos of him then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's visit with 92-year-old Mike Martinez of Fort Collins, Colorado. He survived the Battle of the Bulge in Europe, attached to the 82nd Airborne Division, involved in some of the fiercest fighting around Bastogne, Belgium, where thousands of soldiers died. And you told us right before the break that you were on the crew of a 50-caliber machine gun. Was that air-cooled or water-cooled?
Air-cooled. Yeah, we didn't have any water-cooled because water would be kind of hard to get, and we had to, every little bit, we had to change the barrel on it to keep a cool barrel on there. So that's the way it worked. We changed the barrels on it to keep a cool barrel on it, or it would have never been any good. That barrel would have caved in or whatever they do. But that's what we did. We used an air cool, and every so often you change barrels. It's like going after, you know, you got all your ammunition there, but you still had to go get the ammunition. And that's where what saved my bacon was. I had to go pick some ammo, and I'd leave. I'd come back. All I'd find was a hole in the ground. The Germans wanted that machine gun, and they took it, and they were very accurate with it.
How many men are on a crew for that 50-caliber machine gun?
4. 2 on the machine. There was a guy shooting the machine, and then there was a guy over there feeding him the ammo, and then it was 2 of us carrying the ammo and setting it over there. So there was four of us assigned to it. And that's when we had a full crew, but a lot of times we only had three, and sometimes even two, because, you know, we were pretty well controlled by the Germans. They controlled our crews, and it was something else to control them. And then we did not get our supplies in Belgium because the weather was not that great, and it was cold. I mean, it was cold. They claimed that was the coldest it had been for 50 years, and I don't know if that was true or not, but, I mean, we suffered. And we were not prepared for winter. We had to gang up at nights and get together, sleep real close to one another so our heat of our bodies would kind of help stay warm. And I guess it did because we managed to survive. A lot of people didn't. And some people dug foxholes. We did not dig foxholes. We did not have time to dig foxholes. Oh, some of us did or tried to, you know. But most of us did not because we were kind of in the move either one way or the other one. Because we did give ground to the Germans not only once, several times, sometimes a little bit, sometimes a lot. And it was something else. And then our planes had come over and did make a mistake. Communication is not like they are today. So even our own airplanes would bomb us now and then. And that was something else. Makes you regret what went on. It was not their fault because, yes, they had a certain area to bomb, but they showed up at the wrong place at the wrong time because the weather was so bad. And the plans were made, per se, a week ahead of schedule, and well, not that long, but and they got out there, sent out there to bomb the Germans, and we'd gain ground so they'd bomb us. So we were kind of restricted on how we moved, but we had to move because George said we had to go. And I mean, when George said, you gotta go, you gotta go. And if you remember, you've heard of old Blood and Guts.
Yep.
He was the guts and we were the blood, and it was something else. And he controlled about everything out there.
I remember my grandfather telling me that. He was at the Battle of the Bulge as well in Bastogne where you were, and he said that's what all the soldiers called him, our blood, his guts. And you just said the same thing. So George S. Patton was the general that you're talking about, and he did want you guys to move. And you're talking about the Battle of the Bulge. Of course, you don't know at the time that it's going to be this legendary battle. You don't know what it's going to be called or any of that. You just know that you're in a freezing part of Europe. And like you said, nowhere to really lay your head at night. I mean, nowhere to take cover. Your own planes are bombing you. How did you get by day to day? What was it that kept you going?
Oh, it was not as easy road to hoe, I'll tell you that. We had to rough it out real bad. Yeah, because, see, we never got... See, our planes could not give us what we needed a lot of times. Now, like, take for example, you probably heard this. The 101st was right there close to us. And they never got any supplies, as far as I know, because we used to give them some of our supplies so they could survive. Because they didn't have no ammunition to speak of, nothing to eat. They had a few sea rations, so we'd have to share with them. It was a rough road to hoe. I mean, to tell you, it was not an easy way to go. How we survived, I don't really know. I guess by really getting out there and really working for what we could get.
The 101st was famously cut off there. You were attached to the 82nd Airborne, and... I know that the days probably blended together. You probably didn't get a whole lot of sleep and you were freezing your tail off. But as far as the kinds of things that you would do or how a day would unfold, are you trying to find a position for that gun? Are you just trying to make sure nobody shoots you? I mean, how did those days kind of unfold for you?
Well, we worked it this way. We had to, yes, we always kept an eye over there on the hillside so we could move over there or whatever or wherever because we were up in the mountains. And yes, we always looked for a place to move to, but we had to work our hides off to keep the spot that we had or the Germans would come in and move us out and they would take over. So we had to be awful careful what we'd done. Like you and I could be sitting here and pretty soon I'd say a word and you would not reply. The Germans would have killed you. You was a dead duck, and here I was, all by myself, wandering around. It was kind of strange to sit in there and wondering where your buddy went. Your buddy went to heaven. At least I hope he did. That's what made it so strange, you know. Then you tried not to get a close friend with you because you was afraid if you come real close, you'd lose your buddy, and you didn't want that. So we kind of, you know, it's not that we didn't like him, it's just that we didn't want to lose a good friend. And I tell you, we lost a lot of good friends.
Yeah, you learned that the hard way, I'm sure. Do you remember the first time that a guy you had gotten to know, the guy that you had served with, was no longer with you and how you handled that?
Oh, yes, and you felt real bad because you lost one of your best friends, you know, and you wondered, well, who's next? And in a way, I guess you didn't feel too bad because you was glad that there wasn't you that was gone. That I do not know. because I never got to be gone, so I'm glad I did not. And I'm glad I felt bad for my friends that I lost. I lost several friends out there that way. I only had one guy that I was with when we went in and we got out together. So he was from California, and I've never seen the guy since we got out of service. But we had quite a time.
Well, you say that. You're just glad it's not you. I'm sure there were times you thought it was going to be you.
Oh, you bet. There are a lot of times. One time I got a bomb landed next to us, and it went off and knocked me down, and I got a concussion out of that, and I didn't think I was going to make it because I couldn't stand up for a week. So here comes the sergeant. He said, "You better get up and do your help us fight this war, or I'm going to shoot you." I said, "Sergeant, I'd be glad if you'd shoot me because I just can't go anymore." But I managed to survive that. The sergeant changed his mind and didn't shoot me, so I'm a happy camper.
How close to you did the bomb hit?
I don't know, but not too far because it wiped a lot of guys out.
Just knocked you guys off your feet?
Yeah. And no, it killed a lot of them. Uh-huh. It killed a few of them. No, them bombs was very, very vicious.
But what happened to you? Were you knocked down or knocked against something?
I was knocked down because I had to get up. I think it was a corporal had helped me up off of there, and away we went. But that was something else. I thought I was never going to recover that one because that was that.
And not to belabor the point, but most people have never experienced that, and we don't know what you went through. So is it a mental fog you're in? Is it a physical thing? Or you just don't feel like yourself? You don't have your wits about you? How would you describe the way you felt in the aftermath of that?
You just didn't have your mental part, mainly. Because, you'd have a mental part. You'd try to get up and go, but you still didn't have the strength or the... I don't know what kept you from going, because you thought you could get up, but you still couldn't. That would be a very hard one to explain. Yeah. You just didn't have it. Although you wanted to, but you couldn't do it. And that's where me and that sergeant got into it. He wanted me to get up, and I couldn't. Yes, I could get up, and I'd fall down. So I don't know.
What finally made a difference? What do you think finally made you better?
Everything healed, I think. Or, you know, it was a concussion that lasts just so long, and it healed, and... That's one of the reasons I managed to survive, and it did not send me to a medic thing. I don't know why, I do not know, but I just laid there on the ground and finally come out of it.
And when you hear that word, that name of that Belgian city, Bastogne, today, what comes to mind?
Oh, a lot of crazy things. You know, the snowstorms that would come, the cold weather, the guys out there that were freezing, and some of them didn't know what to do. And yes, the Germans come in, they wounded a lot of them. There wasn't too much you could do for the poor guys. Yes, you could give them first aid. Yes, you had first aid kits to wrap them up, but it was something else. It is hard to visualize and very, very hard to explain to other people, you know, that you didn't have what it took to survive. But I guess we did, because here we are. There's a lot of us here. Like, for example, there's a guy in Colorado Springs. He jumped in Sicily. He jumped on D-Day. He jumped in Bastogne. He jumped across the river. He made five big jumps like that, and he still survived. He's still bouncing around over there in Colorado Springs. I seen him about 3 months ago walking around. So it is something else, you know, how we survived that.
Well, and what about for you? You just told us about that bomb that really rendered you helpless for quite a while there. What are the other moments that you look back on now and say, how did I survive that?
Oh, it makes you wonder very, very seriously just how in the world we survived that. Because the Germans were not dummies, and they were just as tough as we were. The only thing was that they got spread out thinner than they should have, or they would have won, I believe. Because, I mean, there was a rough road to hoe. It was tough, because them Germans were not easy to push out of the way. Mm-hmm. They held their ground. Well, one thing about it, we had more stuff than they did, in a way, because America is big and they had about everything we needed, but getting it to us was a whole different ballgame. And that was the trouble of the Germans, see. Like, for example, they couldn't use their tanks per se because they did not have any fuel. And the people over there in their cars did not burn gas. Although, in a way, yes, they did burn gas. They would burn the smoke off a fire that they built. Their cars and trucks had a big old pot-bellied stove out there. And they'd build a fire out of that. And then how they did it, I don't know. But they had a pipe in there come down, go through the carburetor of the car, and the smoke off the fire has got gas in it, and that's what the cars would burn, and away they would go. So the tanks could not do that. That was one of the reasons we won. They didn't have quite the amount of supplies that we did.
Have you ever wondered, with the Battle of the Bulge in particular, and your role in it there, have you ever wondered, what if we didn't hold on? What if instead of a bulge, they had actually broken through those American lines?
Oh, yes, I did, because they'd be in control. Well, actually, they did break once. They pushed us back pretty well once, but then we managed to push back. I mean, the main reason was we had more supplies than they did, although we was very short. Our supplies lasted longer than theirs. Because, I mean, them Germans were tough. They were not a pushover at all. Well, I don't imagine none of them were, because I don't even think Japan was. But that's the way it is, you know. Them guys started a war, and they thought they could win, and they had a good start. They just did not have the supplies to fight it like we did, because our supply has been more or less unlimited. And then you got Rosie the Riveter jump in there and helped us out a lot. The thought about Rosie the Riveter, she was something else.
Yeah, she was everywhere in this country all those years ago. So you there, in the snow, in the wind, in these freezing conditions, getting shot at, losing guys left and right, day after day, week after week. Did you think it was ever going to end?
No, I didn't think so. I thought I was going to be left laying there, and that's where things would end for me. But so far, I guess there was not a bullet with my name on it, because they come awful close. I mean, they're very close. And like one of the buddies that went over there at the Battle of the Bulge, he got wounded right away, and they sent him home. But one thing about it, I did make the big parade in New York down Broadway when I come home out of the war. That's one thing. I don't think I'll ever forget that one.
Yeah, I want to hear about that, but I also don't want to let you off the hook here, because you say it came awfully close, and your buddy gets hit. That was a $1 million wound for him, because he got to come home, didn't have to live through the rest of that battle. You did, and when you say they came very close, how close are you talking, Mike?
Well, just figure, you and I are sitting right here together, and you're dead and I'm alive. Now, it couldn't get any closer, so it just come very, very close. How I survived, and a lot of time, one time, the plane come over strafing us, and I got behind a tree, and if it wouldn't have been for that tree, I would have never made it, because, I mean, he was strafing right close. It was not only one airplane. There's two or three of them come over, and they were both strafing the daylights out of us and made us run. Well, you couldn't run, or that I got you. That tree saved my skin, that was for sure. I like that tree for that. But that tree can stay there and not come home.
I wonder if that tree's still there.
I do not know. But like I said, I've had chances to go back. But I don't want to bring back them memories over there. Like, for example, what you and I are talking about, the memory's going to come alive and agitate me a little bit after this, and let me know what I should have not have thought of. It is something else thinking about the memories, you know. Your memories are there, and what you've done is there, and it is something else, the kind of life that you had to lead.
And I've had a lot of guys say that. And as I mentioned, my grandfather was in some of the same places as you were, and he had nightmares and flashbacks till the day he died of some of the guys that he tried to save and couldn't. Is that what you're saying, that when you do something like this, you go back there and talking about it, that tonight when you go to bed, it's going to be hard not to see those things all over again?
That is very true. That is very true. It'll come back. But somebody's got to go there and tell you guys a story anyway, so I guess in a way I'm elected and glad of that, put it that way.
Well, we're thankful you're sharing your story with us today. And if you would like to read more about Mike's experiences, his story is featured in a book called Reflections of Our Gentle Warriors by Brad Hoops, who has been recording veteran stories for over a decade in northern Colorado. That book is available on Amazon, but I also have it linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. More from 92-year-old Mike Martinez in a moment, including an encounter with General Patton and another one with victims of the Holocaust. Also, Mike's emotional journey to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Loeffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, Mike Martinez of Fort Collins, Colorado. He served on a machine gun crew attached to the 82nd Airborne Division in Europe, highlighted by the month he spent battling brutal winter conditions and a desperate enemy in the infamous Battle of the Bulge. That stretched from mid-December 1944 well into January 1945. Maybe you don't know what day is what and if it's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Sunday, but did you know it was Christmas? And how did that Christmas of 44 happen for you?
Oh, it was Christmas of 44. Yes, we did, because it let us know. But guess what we had? We had sea rations for dinner that day, and it was great. Oh, I guess we had to be happy that at least we got to eat dinner. That was a very rough day. Them Germans made sure we didn't celebrate, I guess, because they come at us from, it seemed like, all directions. And month of December was very rough, for sure. You know, they started hitting us real rough about the 15th. And we'd been at them before, but I think it started about the 15th. It started to get a little rougher, or we thought it was a little rougher. Maybe we were more tired. I don't know. Did we run from the bullets, or did we hide from the bullets, or how come we managed to survive that? I do not know, because they were there, and they were willing to kill us. A few of us survived, but a lot of us died. A lot of us are still laying there.
And when it comes to Christmas, not that it sounds like you had much time to think about anything other than, like you say, surviving, but did that thought come to your mind? I wonder what's happening back home in Colorado, what my family's doing right now for Christmas?
Actually, we didn't have much time to think about it. You know, we're too busy trying to save our skin. It was something else.
What about when the Battle of the Bulge finally ended? Was that a relief? Did you guys even realize it? Were you too exhausted to know the difference? What do you remember about that?
Well, in a way, yes, we knew the Battle of the Bulge was over, but in a way, no, because we had a rough road to hoe till we got to Munich. We went all the way down through there, and we got up to Munich, and then it got loud. By the time we got to Munich, you could say the war was over. Then is when 82nd and I, we split up. My group split up from the 82nd, was in Munich, and they went into Berlin. We went to Austria. But the war was over once we hit Munich, and they lost, and we won. And that's what made it so great, that we finally won, and I was ready to come home, and I had enough points that I was in the first bunch that come. So I was one of the early birds to come home, I guess you could state it that way.
Before you came home, I know a lot of guys that were in and around Munich in that time period made it past the Dachau concentration camp. Is that something that you experienced?
The Dachau, no, I did not make that one, but I made another. We liberated another woman's detention center. And then poor women, it was cold when we got there. We hit the concentration camp. We liberated, and we could not stop. We had to go right on through. We had another crew behind us to take care of them. They were practically naked. One thing you notice, they didn't have no hair at all, not even on their heads, that they were ready for the gas chamber. And wow. Then women were very happy that we to see us come in. It was something else to see a bunch of American GIs come in and liberate them. Because, I mean, they had older people and younger people. They had them all in there. And there was nothing but women in that camp.
And you remember it now, and you've told this story a few times. But in 1945, did you have any idea that anything like this could even exist, that people could be living in those kind of conditions?
No. The conditions were something else. How they lived, you know.
I mean, that had to be a shock to you to see that.
Well, we knew the what was going on. We'd heard about it, you know. But we did not know we was going to liberate the camp when we did. At least the lower ranks of the Army didn't, but the officers probably did.
Yeah.
That was for sure. And we had quite a time. And crossing them rivers over there was another thing that we had to, you know, you had to be awful careful because they were very tough to cross. I mean, they're not little rivers, they're big rivers.
So how would you guys do it?
We had to have boats to cross, and because they're about a mile wide, and how deep they are is God only knows. Well, they probably know, but I never did know, but they were pretty deep.
They take a few of you in a boat at a time at night, or what?
Yes, or whenever they thought of, you know, Patton, whenever he got the crazy idea we had to go, we went.
Speaking of old blood and guts, and you made reference to him earlier, did you ever see him? Were you ever in a spot where he came through with those famous pearl-handled pistols?
You know, when I hit France, that was the first guy I met.
What?
Person to person, yes. Well, I got out there, and I was standing with mud clear up to my knees almost, and the first thing he said, you better shine them shoes and get a shave. At the time, I don't remember if I was old enough to shave or not, but them shoes could have never been shined and done any good. But man, he jumped on me real rough about me not shining my shoes. I'll never forget that one. I'll never forget old blood and guts. But he was one of the first officers I met over there.
I could see how that would stick with you. You get done with the Bulge, you cross the Rhine, you cross the Elbe, you get to Munich. And you said you liberated that concentration camp. And here this whole time in the war, you've been firing at the enemy. And you know that there are guys that are dying on the other side of that machine gun. But to have that chance to liberate a camp and see these women who were so close to death. I mean, who knows how close to death? And you helped save their lives. What did that feel like to know that you helped save their lives?
Well, you know, we never thought about it really that way, but we knew we did. We were thankful that we did. And like I said, we wasn't able to stop. We had to keep on going because we had to keep the Germans moving or they would... we were afraid if they ever got a foothold, things would start getting real rough. Our group kept on pushing the best we could, and then we had a group behind us to come up and to help them get situated, you know, take baths and get clothes or whatever they did. We couldn't stop and visit with them at all. We just had to keep on going, which I'm thankful we did that, or we'd have had some crazy thoughts about that, I guess, you know, about remembering, feeling sorry for them mainly. Because they were in a bad shape. You could tell they were. I doubt that they'd been fed for a day or two.
And you've told us about some of the close calls from bombs going off, from your own planes bombing you to the German planes bombing you, the one that knocked you off your feet and really had you out of sorts for quite a while, the bullets that are hitting guys next to you but not you. And I don't want to put words in your mouth because a lot of people feel a different way. Some guys say, hey, I was just lucky that bullet didn't have my name on it. Some guys said, hey, there was definitely somebody looking out for me and making sure I came home. Where do you fit? I'm sure you've thought about that a time or two over the years. What do you think about the fact that you went through everything you did and you still made it home?
You know, that makes you wonder, you know. Now, was a good Lord up above taking care of me? Or is it just that the Germans forgot to put my name on that bullet? That one is very hard and makes you wonder just how in the world did you survive that? Because it was a very rough road to hoe, you know, to see the guy. A lot of times the guy on your left was died, the guy on your right died, and here you were standing out in front in the middle and watching them come after you. What saved your bacon? I do not know. The good old boy up above, I guess, is the only conclusion we can come to. He took good care of us.
And maybe this is a dumb question, but I've got to ask it. Were you scared?
Well, I guess the answer is going to have to be yes. But we were so scared we didn't know we were scared because I don't know. Yes, we were scared. Very scared, I would imagine. But like I said, we don't really know why or what. Now, I do know that for Christmas of 44, I did cry for my mommy because we didn't have a Christmas dinner. I guess maybe that's the reason I had to cry for her, but that was the way it went.
And when you found out that the Germans had officially surrendered, was there some celebration at that point?
Yes, I was in Brussels having a great time, and we were late coming back. But, you know, they never said a thing about us being late, because we took a couple extra days off. It was something else. The celebration we had was unbelievable. But the war had slowed down by then, you know, quite a bit. And that's the reason we got our R&R, because they figured, I guess, they really didn't need us that bad, but they did need us. So we took off, and that's the only R&R we got was at that time. Outside of that, I mean to tell you, it was just, I guess, mainly listening to old Blood and Guts giving instructions. And I mean to tell you, he had a lot of instructions, but you'd never seen him out there holding your hand.
Well, speaking of hands and fingers and toes and a nose and your ears, so many guys that went through the Battle of the Bulge, especially as long as you did, had frostbite, had lingering injuries from exposure. Did you ever deal with anything like that?
Yes, I dealt with frost on my toes, that's for sure. See, what we did a lot, maybe because I was a country boy, I don't know, but I learned you had to wrap something on your feet to kind of help them out. And we went out there and looked for dead Americans and stole their blankets from them. Well, we didn't steal them because they were dead. And we cut them up and wrapped them around our feet in order to keep our feet from freezing. And I think I started that, and everybody else followed. And that was great, you know. A lot of guys survived that way. But a lot of guys did freeze their feet. It was something else, as cold as it was. Because we didn't have no overshoes. I guess they were not invented or something. The Army never furnished. See, we were kind of unprepared for cold weather like that when we went over there. We didn't have any good winter clothes, per se.
So you do come home, get into New York City. Did you sail past the statue?
Yes, we did. We definitely did. But then they let us off there, and we paraded down Broadway and had a happy time.
So what was that like to get home and see your family again?
Oh, it was something else. It was more or less unbelievable. Like I said, communications is not like they are today. They knew I was coming home, but they didn't know when. And I surprised the daylights out of them.
You still remember that look on your mom's face?
Oh, you bet I do. She was something else, and she had to give me a big old bear hug, and you know how the moms are. A mom really loves you, that's for sure.
And you made reference earlier, you became a broadcast engineer. You used the GI Bill and went to college. And you worked at TV stations or radio stations or what?
Radio stations. I worked as chief engineer for radio stations. There was one in Durango, one in Cortez, and one in Blanding that I worked with, and there was one in New Mexico.
I'm sure there's a lot that I'm leaving out that you could tell us a lot of stories, but I want to make sure I ask you about Honor Flight, because you went to Washington, D.C. with Northern Colorado Honor Flight, got to see the World War II Memorial with all those gold stars representing 406,000 Americans who didn't come home, so many of them killed at the Battle of the Bulge, where you somehow survived. What was that like for you to go to that memorial?
Oh, it was something else. Kind of unbelievable, you know, what they've done. Yes, we had quite a time. I enjoyed going back there to see it. First, I didn't want to go, but I'm glad I did. And they'd done a great job.
Why didn't you want to go?
Because I was afraid of the memories it'd bring. But I did want to go to see what they'd done, you know. And it does bring memories. Anytime you mention them battles, memories do come alive. That's what you want to stay from. It is over with. You want to forget it. And if we don't watch it, we're liable to have one here. But we hope not. We hope everything stays like it is right now. A war is not a picnic. A war means the disasters you see during a war are something else. The Germans had money, yes. I'm talking about civilians. But they didn't have nothing to eat. They couldn't buy anything to eat. They'd give anything for a piece of candy. It was unbelievable what you saw.
Did you have the chance to share some candy with some Germans?
Oh, yes. Every GI did. Every GI in the world definitely shared. The Germans would let you know. I don't know how they found out that you had candy, because you got a little candy on your sea rations and stuff like that, and they found out about it.
These are children or what?
Children and grown-ups. They wanted gum or they wanted candy, and they also even wanted cigarettes. So there you go, you know. But they were after candy a lot because they were hungry and they needed something to eat, especially chocolate. About everyone you run into wanted chocolate. You got any chocolate candy? And believe me, them Germans could talk English just as well as you can. And you didn't want to tie into a spy and try to corner him and try to catch him on something. And if you hit him with history, he knew more history about America than you did. How well trained the Germans were.
And sorry for bouncing around, but with your trip to Washington, when you were at that World War II memorial and looking at everything there, I'm sure you saw the pillar with Colorado etched on it. You saw that section that is dedicated specifically to the Battle of the Bulge, which you survived. And, of course, those gold stars. What did you think about while you were there?
I think that was a great honor that the place done us, and I thought that was great. That's one thing I thought about it, and I was glad that it was there. And it was great that I got to go there and visit it and see it, you know.
Did it make you feel that maybe people understand that what you did was pretty significant?
Some people, I'm going to put it this way, the majority of the people, yes, they've seen it, they understand, and they will honor it. And I'm glad of that. That's all I'm going to say about that one, because I could bring up a story in there that would probably both wind up in trouble. With what's going on out in this country anymore. You know, the wars were made to win, and yes, we won them. Yes, we fought with everything we had, and I'm glad that we managed to survive all them wars like we have. But we're going to run into one that we're not going to win one of these days, because we're just getting too well scattered, and then people's going to realize just what a war is, and a lot of people do not know what a war is. It's something to read about. That's the way they look at it. Or a TV movie. No, a war is not a thing you want to live in, that's for sure.
And I think what I hear you saying there, when you say we're too scattered, are you saying that America today is so divided that it wouldn't have what you guys had 70 years ago, which was a country united, and that's why you were able to win the war? Am I on the right track?
Yes, sir. That's exactly more or less what I mean. Because this country's getting divided pretty well. Because look, we're not backing up our country.
What do you think of when you see the American flag?
I think it's a great honor to see the flag. That's another thing. That's a touchy situation. A lot of people do not honor it, and they do not respect it.
What does it mean to you? What does it symbolize?
It symbolizes the freedom of our country and how we will support it. And we will support it with everything we got.
And you've done that. And I want to thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us a little bit of your story. Is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
I guess most thankful for is that I went over there, helped our country survive and get liberated. And the biggest thing is that I managed to come home. And that's where the thing that I'm mostly thankful for. And how I managed to do that, I do not know, because that would be a big mystery.
Well, you know, one of the good things about mysteries is they make us stop and think a little bit. And you've given us a lot to think about today. Mike Martinez of Fort Collins, Colorado. See what he looks like on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page or at hometownheroesradio.com, where you can also order that book by Brad Hoops that includes Mike's story and dozens more. Again, the title of that book, Reflections of Our Gentle Warriors. We're out of time for now, but I hope you'll join us again next time here on Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you once more that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.